Chapter 15. He observed that certain inscriptions were met with in greater frequency than others, such as or sale cheap, billiards semicolon s, T1860X, Kino, ale on draft. Naturally, then, these must be religious maxims. But this idea was cast aside by and by, as the mystery of the strange alphabet began to clear itself. In time, the professor was enabled to translate several of the inscriptions with considerable plausibility, though not to the perfect satisfaction of all the scholars. Still, he made constant and encouraging progress. Finally, a cavern was discovered with these inscriptions upon it. Waterside Museum. Open at all hours. Admission 50 cents. Wonderful collection of wax works, ancient fossils, etc. Professor Woodlouse affirmed that the word museum was equivalent to the phrase umgathmolo, or Uriel Plus. Upon entering, the scientists were well astonished. But what they saw may be best conveyed in the language of their own official report. Erect, in a row, were a sort of rigid great figures which struck us instantly as belonging to the long-extinct species of reptile called man, described in our ancient records. This was a peculiarly gratifying discovery, because of late times it has become fashionable to regard this creature as a myth and a superstition, a work of the inventive imaginations of our remote ancestors. But here, indeed, was man, perfectly preserved, in a fossil state. And this was his burial place, as already ascertained by the inscription. And now it began to be suspected that the caverns we had been inspecting had been his ancient haunts in that old time that he roamed the earth, for upon the breast of each of these tall fossils was an inscription in the character heretofore noticed. One read, Captain Kidd the Pirate, another, Queen Victoria, another, Abe Lincoln, another, George Washington, apostrophe etc. With feverish interest we called for our ancient scientific records to discover if perchance the description of man there set down would tally with the fossils before us. Professor Woodlouse read it aloud in its quaint and moldy phraseology, to wit, in the time of our fathers man still walked the earth, as by tradition we know. It was a creature of exceeding great size, being compassed about with a loose skin, sometimes of one color, sometimes of many, the which it was able to cast at will, which being done, the hind legs were discovered to be armed with short claws like to a mole's but broader, and the forelegs with fingers of a curious slimness, and a length much more prodigious than a frog's, armed also with broad talons for scratching in the earth for its food. It had a sort of feathers upon its head such as hath a rat, but longer, and a beak suitable for seeking its food by ye smell thereof. When it was stirred with happiness, it leaked water from its eyes, and when it suffered or was sad, it manifested it with a horrible hellish cackling clamor that was exceeding dreadful to hear, and made one long, that it might rend itself and perish, and so end its troubles. Two mans being together, they uttered noises at each other like this colon ha ha ha, damn good, together with other sounds of more or less likeness to these, wherefore ye poets conceived that they talked, but poets be always ready to catch at any frantic folly, God he knows. Sometimes this creature goeth about with a long sticky which it putteth to its face, and bloweth fire and smoke through ye same with a sudden, and most damnable bruit and noise, that doth fright its prey to death, and so seizeth it in its talons, and walketh away to its habitat, consumed with a most fierce and devilish joy. Apostrophe apostrophe, now was the description set forth by our ancestors wonderfully endorsed and confirmed by the fossils before us, as shall be seen. The specimen marked Captain Kidd was examined in detail. Upon its head and part of its face was a sort of fur like that upon the tail of a horse. With great labor its loose skin was removed, whereupon its body was discovered to be of a polished white texture, thoroughly petrified. The straw it had eaten, so many ages gone by, was still in its body, undigested, and even in its legs. Surrounding these fossils were objects that would mean nothing to the ignorant, but to the eye of science they were a revelation. They laid bare the secrets of dead ages. These moldy memorials told us when man lived, and what were his habits. For here, side by side with man, were the evidences that he had lived in the earliest ages of creation, the companion of the other low orders of life that belonged to that forgotten time. Here was the fossil nautilus that sailed the primeval seas. Here was the skeleton of the mastodon, the ichthyosaurus, the cave bear, the prodigious elk. Here, also, were the charred bones of some of these extinct animals, and of the young of man's own species, split lengthwise, showing that to his taste the marrow was a toothsome luxury. It was plain that man had robbed those bones of their contents, since no tooth-dash mark of any beast was upon them, albeit the tumble bug intruded the remark that no beast could mark a bone with its teeth, anyway. Here were proofs that man had vague, groveling notions of art, for this fact was conveyed by certain things marked with the untranslatable words, flint hatchets, knives, arrowheads, and bone ornaments of primeval man. Some of these seemed to be rude weapons chipped out of flint, and in a secret place was found some more in process of construction, with this untranslatable legend, on a thin, flimsy material, lying by. Jones, if you don't want to be discharged from the museum, make the next primeval weapons more careful. You couldn't even fool one of these sleepy old scientific grannies from the college with the last ones. And mind you, the animals you carved on some of the bone ornaments is a blame sight too good for any primeval man that was ever fooled. Varnum, manager. Back of the burial place was a mass of ashes, showing that man always had a feast at a funeral else, why the ashes in such a place, and showing, also, that he believed in God and the immortality of the soil else, why the solemn ceremonies? 2. Sum up. We believe that man had a written language. We know that he indeed existed at one time, and is not a myth. Also, that he was the companion of the cave bear, the mastodon, and other extinct species, that he cooked and ate them, and likewise the young of his own kind. Also, that he bore rude weapons, and knew something of art, that he imagined he had a soul, and pleased himself with the fancy that it was immortal. But let us not laugh. There may be creatures in existence to whom we, and our vanities and profundities may seem as ludicrous. End of part 2nd. Some learned fables for good old boys and girls, part 3rd. Near the margin of the great river, the scientists presently found a huge shapely stone, with this inscription. N1847, in the spring, the river overflowed its banks, and covered the whole township. The depth was from 2 to 6 feet. More than 900 head of cattle were lost, and many homes destroyed. The mayor ordered this memorial to be erected to perpetuate the event. God spare us the repetition of it. With infinite trouble, Professor Woodlouse succeeded in making a translation of this inscription, which was sent home, and straightway an enormous excitement was created about it. It confirmed, in a remarkable way, certain treasured traditions of the ancients. The translation was slightly marred by one or two untranslatable words, but these did not impair the general clearness of the meaning. It is here presented. 1847 years ago, the fires descended and consumed the whole city. Only some 900 souls were saved, all others destroyed. The king commanded this stone to be set up to prevent the repetition of it. This was the first successful and satisfactory translation that had been made of the mysterious character left behind him by extinct man, and it gave Professor Woodlouse such reputation that at once every seat of learning in his native land conferred a degree of the most illustrious grade upon him, and it was believed that if he had been a soldier and had turned his splendid talents to the extermination of a remote tribe of reptiles, the king would have ennobled him and made him rich. And this, too, was the origin of that school of scientists called monologists, whose specialty is the deciphering of the ancient records of the extinct bird termed man. For it is now decided that man was a bird, and not a reptile. But Professor Woodlouse began and remained chief of these, for it was granted that no translations were ever so free from error as his. Others made mistakes, he seemed incapable of it. Many a memorial of the lost race was afterward found, but none ever attained to the renown and veneration achieved by the Aeridish stone, it being so called from the word air in it, which, being translated in, Aeridish stone was but another way of saying in stone. Another time the expedition made a great end. It was a vast round flattish mass, 10 frog spans in diameter and 5 or 6 high. Professor Snail put on his spectacles, and examined it all around, and then climbed up, and inspected the top. He said, "The result of my perlustration and perscintation of this isoperimetrical protuberance is a belief that it is one of those rare and wonderful creation left by the mound builders. The fact that this one is lamellibranchiate in its formation simply adds to its interest as being possibly of a different kind from any we read of in the records of science, but yet in no manner marring its authenticity. Let the megalophonous grasshopper sound a blast, and summon hither the perfunctory and circumferaneous tumblebug, to the end that excavations may be made and learning gather new treasures." Not a tumblebug could be found on duty, so the mound was excavated by a working party of ants. Nothing was discovered. This would have been a great disappointment, had not the venerable Omlex explained the matter. He said, "It is now plain to me that the mysterious and forgotten race of mound builders did not always erect these edifices as mausoleums, else in this case, as in all previous cases, their skeletons would be found here, along with the rude implements which the creatures used in life. Is not this manifest?"
"True,
true," from everybody. "Then we have made a discovery of peculiar value here. A discovery which greatly extends our knowledge of this creature in place of diminishing it. A discovery which will add luster to the achievements of this expedition and win for us the commendations of scholars everywhere. For the absence of the customary relics here means nothing less than this. The mound builder, instead of being the ignorant, savage reptile we have been taught to consider him, was a creature of cultivation and high intelligence, capable of not only appreciating worthy achievements of the great and noble of his species, but of commemorating them. Fellow-scholars, this stately mound is not a sepulcher, it is a monument." A profound impression was produced by this. But it was interrupted by rude and derisive laughter, and the tumblebug appeared. "A monument," quoth he. "Monument set up by a mound builder. Aye, so it is. So it is, indeed, to the shrewd keen eye of science, but to an ignorant poor devil who has never seen a college, it is not a monument, strictly speaking, but is yet a most rich and noble property, and with your worship's good permission I will proceed to manufacture it in 2 spheres of exceeding grace." And the tumblebug was driven away with stripes, and the draftsmen of the expedition were set to making views of the monument from different standpoints, while Professor Woodlouse, in a frenzy of scientific zeal, traveled all over it and all around it hoping to find an inscription. But if there had ever been one, it had decayed or been removed by some vandal as a relic. The views having been completed, it was now considered safe to load the precious monument itself upon the backs of 4 of the largest tortoises, and send it home to the King's Museum, which was done, and when it arrived it was received with enormous mat, and escorted to its future abiding place by thousands of enthusiastic citizens, King Bullfrog XVI, himself attending and condescending to sit enthroned upon it throughout the progress. The growing rigor of the weather was now admonishing the scientists to close their labors for the present, so they made preparations to journey homeward. but even their last day among the caverns bore fruit, for one of the scholars found in an out-of-the-way corner of the museum a burial plus a most strange and extraordinary thing. It was nothing less than a double man-bird lashed together breast to breast by a natural ligament, and labeled with the untranslatable words, Siamese twins. The official report concerning this thing closed thus. Wherefore it appears that there were in old times two distinct species of this majestic fowl, the one being single, and the other double. Nature has a reason for all things. It is plain to the eye of science that the double man originally inhabited a region where dangers abounded. Hence he was paired together to the end, that while one part slept the other might watch, and likewise that, danger being discovered, there might always be a double instead of a single power to oppose it. All honor to the mystery-dispelling eye of godlike science. And near the double man bird was found, what was plainly an ancient record of his, marked upon numberless sheets of a thin white substance and bound together. Almost the first glance that Professor Woodlouse threw into it revealed this following sentence, which he instantly translated and laid before the scientists, in a tremble, and it uplifted every soul there with exultation and astonishment. In truth it is believed by many, that the lower animals reason and talk together. When the great official report of the expedition appeared, the above sentence bore this comment. Then there are lower animals than man. This remarkable passage can mean nothing else. Man himself is extinct, but they may still exist. What can they be? Where do they inhabit? One's enthusiasm bursts all bounds in the contemplation of the brilliant field of discovery and investigation here thrown open to science. We close our labors with the humble prayer that Your Majesty will immediately appoint a commission, and command it to rest not, nor spare expense until the search for this hitherto unsuspected race of the creatures of God shall be crowned with success. The expedition then journeyed homeward after its long absence and its faithful endeavors, and was received with a mighty ovation by the whole grateful country. There were vulgar, ignorant carpers, of course, as there always are, and always will be, and naturally one of these was the obscene tumble bug. He said that all he had learned by his travels was that science only needed a spoonful of supposition to build a mountain of demonstrated fact out of, and that for the future he meant to be content with the knowledge that nature had made free to all creatures, and not go prying into the august secrets of the deity. My late senatorial secretaryship, written about 1867. I am not a private secretary to a senator anymore I know. I held the berth 2 months in security and in great cheerfulness of spirit, but my bread began to return from over the waters then, that is to say, my works came back and revealed themselves. I judged it best to resign. The way of it was this. My employer sent for me one morning tolerably early, and, as soon as I had finished inserting some conundrums clandestinely into his last great speech upon finance, I entered the presence. There was something portentous in his appearance. His cravat was untied, his hair was in a state of disorder, and his countenance bore about it the signs of a suppressed storm. He held a package of letters in his tense grasp, and I knew that the dreaded Pacific mail was in. He said, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.